What's up, guys? Rachel Lindsay here, and I am teaming up with your favorite Ringer podcasters to deliver the Bravo drama and news that you've been craving on Morally Corrupt. It's the show about all things Bravo, from The Housewives to Summer House and everything in between. We'll be mentioning it all every week. Check it out on Spotify and theringer.com.
This episode is brought to you by Mint Mobile. If you've had it with your overpriced wireless plan with its insanely high monthly bill and unexpected overages, then listen to this. For a limited time, wireless plans from Mint Mobile are $15 a month when you purchase a three-month plan. That's unlimited talk, text, and data for $15 a month. Wow, right? To get this new customer offer, just go to mintmobile.com/watch. That's mintmobile.com/watch. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first three-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for more details.
Just because you wrestle alligators for a living doesn't mean you should have the skin of one. Say goodbye to dry and cracked skin with Old Spice Super Hydration Body Wash with vitamin B3. Made for 24/7 renewing moisturization with daily use. With scents of vanilla and shea, people will think you've taken up candle making as one of your hobbies. And there is nothing wrong with that. Old Spice Super Hydration Body Wash. Shop Old Spice now.
I need support staff to clear the room.
Stand up and walk. Now.
Hello and welcome to The Watch. My name is Chris Ryan. I am an editor at TheRinger.com. And joining me on the other line, yes sir, it's Andy Greenwald.
Ew,
what's up? Andy, it's a very special episode of The Watch. It's Monday. I hope everybody's enjoying their long weekend. But we wanted to make sure that we got after this We Own the City series finale. It's probably collectively me and Andy's favorite show of the year so far. And to celebrate it, we have George Pelicanos, one of the creators and showrunners, the showrunner of the series. And it's George's fourth time on The Watch. He's one of our favorite writers. Obviously, he's done tremendous work on The Wire and The Deuce, but is one of our favorite crime novelists over the last couple of decades. And
Andy, the Sweet Forever remains maybe one of our formative texts.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know. Do you want to talk a little bit about the show? I mean, we talked to George for nearly an hour and we hit almost every major facet of the show, including the finale. But if you wanted to share a couple of thoughts, let's go for it.
Well, yeah, I think the thing about the show that I found so striking at the end was both how it managed to do two things at once. It returned us to not just a city, but a style of storytelling that we have been missing since The Wire, right? We were back on the streets of Baltimore. Both sides of the crime ball are full in effect on the show, and sometimes in some surprising ways. But also, more than just the setting and some very familiar faces, Simon and Pelicanos' ability to tell a story as diffuse as this, as digressive as this, as wide as this, but with such laser-sharp focus that you feel you are learning as much as possible about something that is still fundamentally unknowable. I mean, like The Wire, We Own the City is a show about systemic corruption, systemic problems. And it tells a story that has no solution with their trademark mix of kind of like hopelessness and joy somehow. These people are alive despite the circumstances, despite monstrous acts and despite monstrous context. I found, though, this series to be so rewarding because of its, I guess its brevity. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's hard to say that it's brief considering every episode of The Six is packed. It's like 59
minutes. I think
we mentioned
that it had the energy and the pace and the momentum of a tightly scripted British crime show that goes 4 or 6 episodes.
Yes, absolutely. With now, and this is a new element, with some of the cinematic style of, as George talks about, his favorite 70s crime films, thanks to the director, Reynaldo Marcus Green. But it was so focused in its way, you know, that the things that the show built to, not in the penultimate episodes as it happened on The Wire or in the fourth season as happened with The Wire, but just after 6 episodes to see the arc of this, a story that forecast its ending for the most part, right? That was spoiled by Wikipedia, that used court transcripts and wiretap transcripts for huge swaths of dialogue. still found a way to end in a way that felt really resonant and moving and complete. You know, I think I'm really struck by that.
It's in some ways it's very tight. It's like it's got like a middleweight, you know, agility and kind of like it's the way it like dances around the ring. You could say, oh, this is just a very specific Baltimore story about these very specific cops. But I would say that I think that this is a sweeping epic mm-hmm. about the ultimate degradation of 21st century policing. And it's I don't think that that's an overstatement to say that. I think that tracking Jenkins coming out of the academy throughout his time as a beat cop into these plainclothes units and to his ultimate end is it's just been breathtaking. And one of the things that I think you and I grapple with a lot when we read crime fiction, when we watch crime shows, when we watch crime films is the tension between how much they romanticize the behavior that they're depicting and basically intoxicate you with the viewer, you the viewer, with the behavior that you're watching. And I don't necessarily want to watch things that are just indictments of everybody mm-hmm. all the time. You know, I think that there is a sort of compulsion to entertain no matter what when you're telling a story visually. That being said, I just don't know that I've ever had the intellectual and emotional experience of the crime story like I did with this, where I think obviously like in a very, very small community of people, like the Wayne Jenkins stuff has become meme-worthy and how funny and electric and scary Bernthal's character is in this show and how amazing his performance has become. But you are never not thinking to yourself, this guy's a fucking demon. Like you are just the entire time, just like, honestly, it's just the level of how appalled I was watching this. And honestly, like the way it kind of has changed the way I think about like the systems around us and specifically law enforcement has just been pretty profound. And so it was really exciting to talk to George about all of those things.
Yeah. I mean, I love the fact that, I mean, we talked to George about it, but like, I think John Bernthal's performance is one of the great TV performances of this century. I think it is electric. It is magnetic. It is all consuming. It is physical. It's just a marvel, but I don't feel any like moral ambiguity,
nope.
You know, I mean, you know, like Jaws wasn't named after Roy Scheider's character. You know what I mean? Like Jaws was named after the shark.
Yeah,
and I don't think anybody got confused about who they are. I'm not saying this. You're not the straw man.
No, I understand why he's seductive, but I was not seduced. I understand why he is seductive to other cops around him as a character and in this show, but I didn't find myself. There's no moment of Henry Hill is taking Karen on this date, you know, or something like that. Like there's, it doesn't have that feel.
Well, he goes on a date. In the champagne room with an undersized stripper. So I mean, like there's romance in the show. No, I think the other thing about it is that
he has a lovely time at that Harbor Hotel,
the Inner Harbor Hotel. Yeah, a lot of good stuff happens there. Great meals out on the patio. This is a grown folks show. You know what I mean? Like in a way that I just appreciate so much, and The Wire was as well, but Simon and Pelicanos are a little bit older now too and are looking at it with their own life experience and the experience of making TV in this city for so many years, as George talks about with us, and having a very confident hand on how to pick up like, or, you know, have a dalliance with heavy hitting issues or important civic concerns. Like that's what fuels their storytelling. And they approach this material absolutely like with open eyes and open hearts and open ears. It does not feel didactic in any way, but it feels responsible, you know, which is a complicated word to use when you're talking about art that is also, as we're referring to with the Wayne Jenkins performed character, like this is a very entertaining show.
Mm-hmm.
But it feels confident and responsible and thoughtful and in control in a way that I really, really admire and appreciate. And, you know, you're referring to the difference when you're talking about the similarities between this and a tightly paced British procedural types of shows that you and I both love. And every year there's like at least one or two that pops enough for us to talk about on the podcast. One of the things that makes those shows ultimately really, really great, I think, is just the craft. Like the people who make those shows and make them well know how to write teleplays, you know what I mean? And know how to be efficient with it in the same way our favorite novelists do. this isn't exactly that, because when given the choice to showboat or, you know, bring the house down with like a third act, whatever, these guys went to the courthouse transcripts or the proffer session transcripts. You know, they never steer things towards drama, even though they are working as television writers, you know, and in the wrong hands, that could be disastrous. It would be disastrous. And it's just not what it is. They're just so good at what they do at this point. And I feel like the show was kind of a gift.
We are in good hands with George Pelicanos. So Andy, let's get into our interview with the creator and co-creator and showrunner of We Own This City, George Pelicanos.
I'm just overjoyed and thrilled to be joined by one of our favorite writers, one of our favorite guests, making his, I believe, fourth appearance on the podcast. One more and he gets the five-timer smoking jacket, who is joining us today in his capacity as one of the co-creators and the showrunner of our favorite show of the year, HBO's We Own This City. George Pelicanos, welcome back to The Watch.
Thank you. It's good to see you guys.
George, you know, Andy and I adore this show. This has really been kind of a thrill for us to talk about it over the last couple of weeks. Even when I start talking about it, I can feel hints of my Philadelphia accent coming out. So rich is that Northeast Corridor accent work in this show. But let's start at the beginning. You know, you obviously worked on The Wire. The Wire ended in 2008. And the action in We Own the City kind of picks up essentially where the previous show ends. But there's been this decade plus time away from the streets of Baltimore. So I was curious, what brought you and David back to the streets of Baltimore?
There was more to say. And we felt like, you know, we always ask each other, why are we going to do this? Because even though it's six episodes and it goes by in a flash, we worked on it for 3 years. You know, it's a long time out of your life to do something that's inconsequential, you know? So for David, it was the continued failure of the drug war. And as always, we come at it from kind of two different perspectives. He's more of a macro guy. And I'm a little bit more of a micro guy in that, like, I like to dig into the individual characters and that sort of thing. But in terms of thematically, you know, I felt like the thing to discuss beyond the drug war was that, you know, what is police corruption? And the obvious thing is taking money, you know, that sort of thing, confiscating drugs and reselling them out on the street. And those are bad things. But to me, the corruption is, let me just say, I live in Silver Spring, Maryland, which is in a very wealthy county, but it's a divided county. And I live on the other side where mostly minorities are. And I see all the time young people being pulled over and sitting on the curb and you know, sometimes in the middle of winter after midnight for hours while we wait for the drug dogs to come. And it's just harassment, you know. And to me, that's a bigger corruption, because I've been seeing it for years. And it's personal, because I raised two black sons and a Latina daughter, and they've continually been harassed by the police around here. So I wanted to look at that too. And that's why so much of the stories so many of the stories in this show are about, you know, what happens when somebody gets pulled over and they get a few hundred dollars taken out of their glove box. And whether it's drug money or just a paycheck money, what happens to their lives after that? They get locked up for a couple of days, you know. It's an important story to tell.
And you used, I know, one of your favorite actors to work with, Thaddeus Street, to tell some of that story so well in the series, you know, where it's not just, well, for the cops, for Herschel and for Jenkins, some money from a glove box is some crabs and some top shelf liquor for one night. But for a working person who had his entire paycheck taken, there is a cascading series of devastating consequences with no safety net, no backstop for that.
That's right. That's why that whole thread is in there with Thaddeus and his car, which I know you're going to get to it, so I might as well tell you. That's an Impala SS 94, and That car is sitting in my garage right now.
Of course it is.
It's incredible that maybe this is the, I'm excited to have you on for the fourth time, but the danger is you know us as well as we know you now. So yes, I was going to go there. I was going to razz you for the car, but more specifically in the broader context of Justin Fenton's book was published about the true story behind the series. You and David, became interested, became attached. I was curious, though, about the decision for this to be your first solo gig as showrunner. You and David co-created it. He obviously was very involved, produced, wrote the finale. But this was your rodeo.
Well, let me correct that first, because I was also a showrunner on The Deuce.
That's right. But you were technically co-showrunners on that, or is that just semantics at this point?
We were on both shows. I mean, David's my partner, and we split it down the middle. But I got asked first to do this by HBO, and then I called. I said, I'll do it if, I can bring in my old team from The Wire, including David and Nina Noble. I didn't think I could do it without them, meaning they certainly brought a lot to it. She doesn't get enough credit. And it was just good karma. You know what I mean? So, yeah, I mean, I was a showrunner on this, and you've done it. You know what that entails. It's a complete commitment to, your whole life it's 12 to 14 hours a day, every single day. And it's pre-production, it's production, it's post-production. It was great. I loved it because coming back to Baltimore, we were working with crew that we worked with 20 years ago. And for David and Nina, it's closer to 30 because a lot of these people worked on Homicide and The Corner. And what was really gratifying there is we had people who wandered onto set on The Wire. They were teenagers and they didn't want to leave. They were just curious. And we eventually put them on as PAs. And now they're running departments. That doesn't get talked about enough because how you impact people's lives when you run it, when you have these shows, right? Especially locally, you see it because it's our home and you see people grow up and now they're middle-aged people with families and the film business has afforded them the opportunity to have a career and also raise their families like that too. So that's pretty cool, man.
That's incredible.
And though I guess the connection to the early question was just that I assumed that you were the sole showrunner of this because of the car. Because of that moment, because I couldn't imagine David ever allowing that much detail of a car to be in one of his shows. So maybe you guys worked it out.
When it comes to cars and things like that, he doesn't question anything that I,
and he knows too well.
And I have my sons with me on the show and one of my sons is an AD and the other one's in the art department. So they conspire with me on all this stuff and we make sure that we get the right cars into the shots.
Do we get to ask what David Simon drives?
Oh man, he's the most un-car guy.
Yeah.
Like, he's got a Lexus SUV, like the fender is falling off and it just scrapes all over it. I'm like, dude, you've got $100 million or whatever you got. Just go buy a car. Like take that roll of cash in your pocket and start flipping the dollars off. He doesn't care.
George, this is a different kind of cop than the ones we follow in The Wire. And they've been militarized. They figured out how to game the system and how to write reports and how to fend off litigation. And they're addicted to overtime. Were these kinds of plainclothes units rolling around the time of Bunk and McNulty? And why did they get introduced to this police force?
They were around and every city has them. We have them here in D.C., the jump out boys, and they roll out and then they come out of their cars and they put everybody up against the wall. And what you see in the show is they arrest everybody, not just the guys who have the drugs in their pockets. And then they get the overtime pay for showing up in court and all these things that it incentivizes mass arrest. So they've always been around. The difference is that if you go back to The Wire, remember there was a scene where Burke and Carver, or they're on a raid and they take a little money, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know if you remember that. And now, and that was the worst thing they did. You know, they would rough up some people and things of that nature. We saw all that, but it's magnified 100 times now in 20 years. Again, these guys aren't just stealing money. They're selling drugs on the street, and they're bilking the city for hundreds of thousands of dollars in overtime every year for each guy. You know, it's just become rampant. And that made it, that further legitimized us going back and looking at it, because the guys who were trained back then and worked in plainclothes and so on are now running departments and squads, and they were trained a certain way. You see it with Jenkins when he comes out of the academy, and that's a real thing. They at the academy, they try to do a good job of indoctrinating these guys about, you know, sensitivity training,
yeah,
racial dynamics, all that stuff. And then they put him with a sergeant who says, you know,
forget all that shit.
I'm going to show you how to police. And the guy, having Treat Williams in there as Graebler was, you know, like it was deliberate, because this is a guy who was in Prince of the City.
Yeah.
And one of our favorite films. And in that film, the IAD says to him, did you guys take drugs too? And he was like, no, you know, like, it's an affront to him to think that any cop would take drugs. Yeah, we took a little money. And then to see how far it's come where they're reselling drugs back out on the street. And that was why we put Treat Williams in that role. He came in for essentially a cameo. We shot him out in one day, but it was really worth it.
Oh, my, he's like the cup of espresso after dinner. He comes in roaring off the bench just for those two scenes, and he's just on fire. It just electrifies the show. Good. George, one of the hallmarks of your books since the beginning, you know, because we love them and have read them all, and also from David's work, has been always kind of articulating an idea that there are, well, articulating nuance first and foremost, but that there are people in the police force who are generally decent people trying to do decent work, even if they're up against a corrupt system or they are party to a corrupt system. That was present in The Wire as well. Since The Wire went off the air, I think, you know, our collective perception of the police and the role in American lives has changed significantly, particularly for those of us who, you know, have not lived in the shadow of Jump Out Boys and have lived a relatively privileged existence, unaware of the level of harassment. Knowing all of this, when you went back into a story about police, how did you navigate that even finer line now? Because one of the things that is so striking about the show is that there are cops like Sean Suter who, you know, is proud of the work he is doing as a homicide police, is doing the best that he can despite some, you know, obviously it becomes the louder, it's a long shadow, his past casts. But you are always attempting, I think, to articulate that nuance. And I'm wondering what it was like to do that in a show that was going to air in 2022.
There are very few characters in the show that aren't real people, you know, based on real people. Steele is the only one who's a composite, the DOJ investigator. Mm-hmm. But somebody like Kostopoulos, for example, who, by the way, I didn't make him Greek. He was Greek. He's a good, guy. And
I got to cross that off my questions then.
We were talking the other day about how that K-Stop scene with Herschel and Jenkins is a lot like when they're sending Karen down to get more for the fur coats and Goodfellas. It's like, keep going. And it's like, okay, stop. Don't get out of the car. Don't leave your phone.
Yeah, he played that well. I mean, that actually happened. They took him into it. It was an alley they took him into that we couldn't shoot in, but one cold night. And they said, well, you know, here's a what if. Like, what if, because Jenkins was really grooming this guy. And he said, you don't do that if you have a badge on your chest. We don't do that shit. And then he got reassigned right after that. They bumped him out of the unit. The guy who unwittingly, you know, gave them the tracker in the first couple of episodes, they figured him out for being a straight arrow too. And they wouldn't let him hang around when they were doing their dirt. And the guy that she goes to visit out at Lincoln Park, who's been banished out there, that happened also. You know, like, and these guys that actually stood tall and complained, they either got reassigned or they got put out to pasture. You know? But there was a lot of good cops that were complaining about this. But it went unheeded, as you can see. One of the reasons that these guys were operated with impunity was they were actually doing a good job. On one hand, they were getting guns and drugs off the street, and this was in a time when post Freddie Gray, when a lot of cops stopped getting out of their cars. So it was important for the department to have units like this that were producing. And they knew it. They knew that they, meaning the GTF guys, they knew that as long as they did A, they could do B as well and get away with it.
The choice to depict some of the Freddie Gray stuff the way he did was very interesting to me, that a lot of that, the aftermath of the Freddie Gray verdict, is played through Jenkins' eyes. And it's a moment, interestingly, for him to be a team player, right? Like, you see the respect that the other cops have for him for grabbing his gear, jumping in a van, providing food and everything. And then you played it so subtly also with the reaction shots to some African-American cops who are seeing, you know, seeing this quite differently, perhaps, than the way he is, as just like a binary, like them against us.
Yeah, I think that they were, the black cops were probably much more conflicted about what was happening. And that happens in every, you know, in my book, Hard Revolution, is all about Strange as a young man trying to police his own people during the 68 riots. Mm-hmm. It's fair to say that, and it's not hyperbole to say that Jenkins acted heroically during the uprising in many, many ways. But then that night he went and looted a Rite Aid drugstore for Oxy.
Yeah. And,
mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And he shows up at washes up on Stepp's door, the bail bondsman, the next morning, and they sell the drugs. So this guy was a very complicated guy. But one thing that since you brought it up, that was fortuitous for us was that, you know, if this squad had been all white guys, then it would have been a different show. But it wasn't. It was a few white guys and actually it was more balanced on black police officers, maybe, you know, 5-3 or something like that. That was a gift to us, because then we didn't have to deal with the idea that here's a bunch of white cops who are assholes.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's not about that. It's about, you know, blue versus the citizenry, what it's become. And again, we stuck to the reality of it, which was fortunate.
Yeah. And it's, you know, you talked about how, you know, this show tracks Jenkins from like essentially his first days on walking the beat to his downfall as part of GTTF. And then in between, you see guys like Ram and Gondo coming in who are, like, for lack of a better term, kind of like gangsters. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, they're much more connected to the streets. I think they look at being in the Gun Trace Task Force as a means to an end. And there's even conversation they have in the car, where he's like, when it ends, it ends. I mean, that's how Avon and Stringer used to talk to each other, you know? And I thought it was kind of fascinating that you've got these two cops who aren't even putting up the pretense of protecting and serving. They're not even kind of like gesturing towards any kind of original mission of the job that they're doing.
Yeah. And by the way, a lot of that dialogue was right straight off the wiretap verbatim.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So, which made it easy for me. And I wanted to include it. The nice thing about it from a dramatic standpoint is that all these cops had different personalities. You're right. Raymond Gondo were nihilists, basically. They knew what was going to happen, and they just kept driving towards that wall. They didn't care. Ward was a guy with a conscience, and he really did throw $20,000 away in the woods before he went home that night, because he didn't want to take it into his house. And then Jenkins was a family man. He would leave a raid or a crime scene to go help his kid out or go to a football game or something like that. He also had women all over the city. The dude was very complicated. And I don't think to this day, you guys have seen all the episodes, he's bewildered at the end.
Mm-hmm.
He still doesn't understand the import of what he did, and he's in denial of it. Herschel as well. Both of those guys were the two cops who didn't talk to the FBI. They got the longest sentences. And from jail, they're still, from prison, they're still protesting their convictions and saying that they were innocent. They continued to.
I know I'm going to clear space in a moment for Chris to talk about John Bernthal with you directly, because I think it's really all he wants to talk about. But staying with this idea about Wayne Jenkins, the actual person, then also as depicted on your show, there's a moment in the finale that I kind of can't get over. I've been thinking about ever since I watched it, which is the scene where he's with two of the other cops and they're getting drinks. They're at the strip club. And he's just saying that he's not a dirty cop. And the other guys are looking at him like, are you insane? And he's insisting that he's a good person, you know? And it just reminded me of this moment that we're living in where on the right, in the American right, the worst thing in the world would be to be called a racist. You don't examine your behavior. You don't have any empathy or consideration of where this is deriving from. It's just that, how dare you besmirch me because I am a good person. And the resentment and grievance and just, you know, the wall that goes around anyone who is accused from the outside of anything. It was it's a powerful scene in your show and speaks so much about the core of this very complicated guy.
One of my favorite scenes is after they rob the car wash and he's in the car with Sean Suter at the end of the episode. And he says, he's trying to talk Sean into taking the money. And he says, you know, why shouldn't we, for a city that doesn't give two fucks about us? Mm-hmm. And he said, I can't, you know, a folded flag's not going to feed my babies. And it's his rationalization for it. And in a way, it makes sense. I mean, I'm kind of proud of the fact that we let these cops make their case. Herschel does the same thing in the bar with mm-hmm. Nicole Steele. Says, you know, yeah, I got complaints. Show me a cop that doesn't have complaints. I'll show you a cop who doesn't get out of his car.
Yeah.
And then the last scene where we go back to the academy and he's talking to and it's all the guys in there that we've seen. That was, David wrote that. I didn't know he was going to write it. It wasn't something we beat out in the writer's room. He just, you know, delivered it to me. And I think it's really extraordinary. I hope he doesn't listen to this because I don't want him to know that, you know, I'm giving him all this praise. But
but you knocked his Lexus, so that's okay.
Yeah, I did put his Lexus down. That shit wagon, he's got to do something about that. But it really worked. And you don't know if something like that's going to work when you write it. You have to film it. And I think it really worked because that was all in Jenkins' head. These guys still look at him heroically, when in fact they all turned on him. I mean, there was a critic who said was unsatisfied because the cops, they started talking as soon as they got into the proper sessions with the FBI, and that's what happened. It's part of the story. They all turned on each other. They sang.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because they were. Thick as thieves, you know, like when they were together, brothers in blue. But as soon as they put the bracelets on them, they started flipped. Talking.
My impression from your show is that the cushiest job, maybe on the whole East Coast for a couple of years, was being one of these guys' defense attorneys.
You could just sort of do, they don't you ever could talk.
You could just do your Headspace meditation app while these guys just sang the entire symphony for the FBI.
I think Ray was the one who's like, why am I paying you $500 an hour? I want to get to Bernthal, but, you know, first I wanted to ask you a quick question about one of the formal quirks, not quirk, one of the choices you guys made while making the show, which is this, I don't know, like almost this, it's like this intuitive kind of wandering timeline, the way that you treat chronology in this show and how it jumps from year to year, from incident to incident, and often unites these moments more thematically than narratively. So it's like, it's important to understand Jenkins, but at the same time, you know, some of it's coming out of interviews with other characters. Some of it's coming out of these documents that you kind of reference on the screen. I understand what it did to me as a viewer, and I understand the cumulative effect it had on my understanding of this story. And I thought it was profound, honestly. Can you tell us a little bit though about how you approach the timeline, the chronology, and the narrative of this show?
I think my recollection is that, you know, we wrote the pilot together. I'll call it the pilot, its first episode. And the idea was that it was going to be it was going to be chronological from then on. Or we would go back and it would be chronological. But we made the decision because if it had, okay, first of all, this is a national story. I just felt a lot of people would know watching this what how it was going to end, that these guys were going to get caught and sent up to prison. We didn't want to train the audience to watch that show because it's not about, you know, it's not like S.H.I.E.L.D. S.H.I.E.L.D.'s a great show, but this isn't really a show about corrupt cops. It's about the why of it. How does it happen? And the only way that we could show that is by jumping around in time effectively and by taking away that element from the viewer, like, oh, this is a thriller. I want to see how they get caught. And putting in the forefront of it is, how did the department evolve? What happened within the department to allow the squad to operate? It wasn't easy. I mean, it was the most challenging thing we've probably ever done, in addition to having to stick to the facts and not get off of that track. And the show, even though it was written that way, the show really got made in the editing room.
Yeah.
Like, we made a lot of changes in the editing room, and I think it was, we post for this show was about 4 months for six episodes, which is a long time. But that's where David and I, and Nina was there too, that's where David and I had the most intense discussions about what we were going to use, where it was going to go. And it was really difficult. And I have to also include HBO, and I'm not blowing smoke up HBO's skirt, but they gave us some really, that's where their notes were really coming from, is they kept pushing us to make it more palatable, mm-hmm. the timeline. And their notes were good. And David came up with the run sheets for Jenkins, which was effective, I thought. We're working with an effects house. We finally figured out how to put that over.
Yeah.
It was a lot. It was a lot, you know?
This episode is brought to you by Mint Mobile. If you've had it with your overpriced wireless plan with its insanely high monthly bill and unexpected overages, then listen to this. For a limited time, wireless plans from Mint Mobile are $15 a month when you purchase a three-month plan. That's unlimited talk, text, and data for $15 a month. Wow, right? To get this new customer offer, just go to mintmobile.com/watch. That's mintmobile.com/watch. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first three-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for more details.
Should we pivot to this lead performance that you coaxed out? Because
yeah. So, Dana, George, I just have to mention that I had Jamie Hector on a couple of weeks ago after episode 3. And I asked him what it was like working with Bernthal, specifically in the car wash scene, but just in general. And he was very, very complimentary. And he was like, he was always moving. And I got this impression of this guy who almost must have been a force of nature on set, because he's such a force of nature on the show. That's not as much of a question as much as it is. I think it's one of the most incredible performances I've seen on TV in recent memory. Did he show up with Wayne Jenkins in his head and doing his voice? And was it just fully formed? What was the process like working with John?
Well, he was always working. So, you know, he came early to Baltimore and he started making relationships with the police. We had this guy Dre on set that was, he was in the GTTF, and he looked up to Jenkins, and because of what happened and with Jenkins and all them, his career sort of got derailed a little bit because they broke up, you know, they killed the unit. And Dre is a diehard, you know, cop, Thin Blue Line guy. He's got a show called the Razorbacks, which is the unit, these guys that are all big, tough cops. Right. And he made a relationship with him and his friends. And a lot of those guys end up in the show. Dre's in it, but also the guy at the car wash who has that exchange with Jenkins. That guy's a cop. The guy who he's riding with when he beats the shit out of this guy on the stoop, that guy's a cop. We used a lot of active duty cops in this show. And So Jenkins, you know, I mean, John was always working beyond what we offered him. And we always offer, you know, we'll put you in contact with the police and do some ride-alongs, that kind of thing. He didn't really take us up on it. He did all this stuff on his own. He was super prepared. And he brought stuff, little things to the scenes that honestly I didn't know about. I mean, I remember one day and he was testifying in court and he came wearing a vest that said the police on it. And somebody came to set and said, no, they would never wear that, you know, in court. And we got to get costumes, you know, like calling out for the costume department, like somebody had messed up. And John pulls a Polaroid out of his vest of Jenkins wearing that very vest in court when he was testifying. Like he knew and we didn't know. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
His physicality is just so incredible. I mean, the name of the show is We Own the City, and he embodies it. The width of his walk, you know, the way he wears those Ravens shirts, like he is someone in
just
a way.
Just the way he
I love when he's pulling the Roger Rabbit out in the street.
Oh my God. But even like the way he litters, like the way he just like throws bottles around, like he just doesn't give a shit.
Exactly. He's like, I don't give a fuck. He throws that bottle before he goes in the bail bondsman's office. You hear it break. It's like, he's a cop. You know what I mean? There's nothing I can't do. And that was his, I mean, John's not method in the sense that you couldn't talk to him after you yelled cut. Like, it's not like he couldn't approach him. But he was ready and he had ideas and he wanted to do things certain ways that a lot of showrunners don't like, but I like it if it's coming from a place of knowledge, you know what I mean? And that's where he was coming from. His suggestion, I didn't let him do everything, but his suggestions were almost always good. And we used a lot of his ad-libs, which are hilarious.
Was Yezzer a Bernthal original? Yeah.
Yeah, and you know when he calls the guy Dum Dum, that like one of the guys they arrest, you know, he said that sound there, Dum Dum. Like, turns out Jenkins used to call guys Dum Dum. I didn't know that. Jesus. He was asking a lot. He was asking these cops a lot of questions about Jenkins and things like, did he like to drive? You know, and Jenkins always wanted to drive the car, so things of that nature. He brought a lot to it. And John's from DC. So we struck up a friendship pretty quickly. I know some of the people he knows. And John was a guy who hung out on the other side of town growing up and got into a bunch of trouble by his own admission. And he's got a lot of life experience, put it that way. He's a genuine tough guy too. Like, you know, the nose that looks broken, it's been broken.
Yeah.
See, we always figured that's a barrier for entry with us and him, but we are also, the three of us are all Quaker school boys too. So I feel like we could probably bond over that, even if he ran from it in the other direction. George, it wasn't just the car that made me feel your touch on the show. And this might just be total projection, so feel free to talk me out of it. But it's not as if you and David haven't worked with incredible actors before. I mean, even just on The Wire, I mean, you had Wood Harris and Idris Elba and Michael B. Jordan was there. And I mean, Wendell Pierce through the deuce with Franco and Gyllenhaal. I mean, you've worked with great actors before. You've also worked with great directors before who suited the material brilliantly. But there was something about this piece, and maybe it's because it was, you know, a limited, with the performance of John at the center of it, and then the direction of Reynaldo Marcus Green throughout, that I thought just elevated the cinematic language of this to a degree that was really striking, really wonderful as a viewer. But I always think of that, but I attributed that subconsciously, I think, to you, because I know from your writing and from conversations, just your love of great cinema and filmmaking in a way, not to discredit David in any way, who has made some of the best TV of our lifetime, but has always seemed to, at least from the outside, approach it from a more journalistic perspective than a cinematic perspective.
Yeah, I think I put it this way. I was very happy to see that's what Ray was doing. Mm-hmm. And we did talk about it. I encouraged it, but I didn't say, I want you to do it this way. We did want it to look different than The Wire, mm-hmm. which was a much more documentary style, I think, than cinematic. But Ray Green's from the beginning said, I want this to look like a movie. And there was the advantage of we had them for all the episodes. So it was one vision. We weren't parachuting directors in and out. And Yaron Orbach, who shot The Deuce for us, thinks the same way. They collaborated. And I didn't have to step in much. I was just more of a cheerleader, like, yeah, I love that. I love the way this is looking. And we chose Ray. I had seen Monsters and Men, and I thought it was a sort of a nuanced take on this kind of material. I didn't see King Richard. It wasn't available for me to see at the time that we hired Ray. But it was a plus that he had worked with John, and they had a pretty strong relationship that helped us as well. And Ray was, so Ray's kind of a quiet guy. He's quiet on set, but you have to, I'm a firm believer in the writer producers being there every day on set. And we were watching, but we kept our distance for the most part, because he was getting what we wanted. And he actually, a lot of writers aren't really great in the editing room, but he gave us, the director gets first edit on all the episodes, and he delivered us some pretty clean episodes from the editing room as well. So I was super happy. He's also a nice person, which is really helpful for me. It's how you treat the crew. It's really right. Important.
You know, that camera he has, it's like another jump out boy. Like, it's always running behind them. It's running into through these doors. It's patrolling. It's looking under cars. I just thought it gave the series such a visceral feel, and it kind of did bring almost an updated new take on Prince of the City, on Serpico, on this like very urban cop drama. I thought that was incredible. I was wondering whether or not that you guys had, whether you had like a common cinematic language of movies that you liked, shots that you liked, like feels that you liked, camera moves that you liked together.
He's from New York, and my favorite movies are the New York 70s films, Sidney Lumet, of course, but also French Connection,
yeah,
Seven Ups, Cross 110th Street. He knew all those films. We talked about it, and it wasn't not at length. We didn't screen films or anything like that together, but he knew the references, and there wasn't a lot of trickery. Like, I have a pet peeve about shots that are either shooting up into the air, or you got to put a camera on top of a building and you're looking down at everybody. And I'm always thinking, like, well, whose point of view is that?
Right.
That suggests to me that somebody's up on top of that building, like a sniper or something like that. Like, don't do it. You know what I mean? And he found a way to, for the camera to tell the story in an organic way.
We have to, when we're naming individual names who contributed to this, I think we have to talk about Wunmi Mosako too, because you mentioned how Nicole, her character, was the only composite of all the people on the screen. After finishing the series, I was even more impressed by her performance, and just thinking about how challenging it was in a lot of ways, because she had to do a lot of expositional lifting with the scenes that she was in, but she also, with her eyes and her reaction shots, had to take in so much of the shit, basically, and have it change her, having gone through it in a way that was similar to what the audience went through, learning about things and experiencing them throughout. And I thought her performance was so noteworthy, not just because of her charisma and her ability and her strength, but her decision making. Like, I kept talking about, I think you heard us say this, the way that she smiles in the first episode. You know, there's a genuine warmth to her and a full person behind all of it that is just evident, was really striking. And I think, having now seen the whole series, it was essential to the viewing experience.
I have to admit, it's going to make me sound stupid, but, you know, I didn't really appreciate her until we got in the editing room and saw these scenes over and over again. And like you say, the subtle reactions and the way her eyes would, when she's talking to Dominic, the head of the union, the police union, how her eyes sort of kind of like begin to cloud over, and the anger builds, but it never boils over. She had, I would say, the hardest role because it is just a lot of listening. And she did a great job. Plus, she has a very, very British accent, and it never once slipped. We didn't have to loop her dialogue or anything.
Yeah, that was unreal. I mean, even the best slip sometimes, and you could tell she didn't.
I felt like she got to have the sister line to get on with it, motherfucker. It was it's your turn, motherfucker. Let's talk about the Sean Suter part of it because it hangs over the series. It's interesting. Like I watched this series initially not knowing as much about Suter as I obviously should have, and in talking to Jamie, you know, did a lot of research into it. This is a very knowing show. It knows every nook and cranny. You leave some ambiguity about what happened to Suter. Obviously, there is some ambiguity about what happened to Suter. There's been a documentary Sonia Soma made about this case.
Yep.
What kind of approach did you take, especially to those final moments of Suter's character? Because there is a degree of mystery about it.
Yeah, it's a good question. First of all, we did a lot of research beyond what was in the book and what was reported in the newspaper. And David used his relationships with police officers who were, homicide detectives who were involved in investigating his death internally. And we know some things that the public doesn't know. Okay, that's all I'll say there. But to be respectful to the family, we made the decision to not show anything that wasn't actually seen. We didn't deduce things and then just decide to shoot it that way. The way we decided to shoot it was there was a camera on one of the houses on that street where he died. And we have the recording of what the camera saw. So we shot that. But when he disappears into that lot, and by the way, we shot it in the exact location where he was killed, which was a triggering thing for our crew. And the camera saw him pacing back and forth behind this van before he went in there. Now, if you know from where he is, from his point of view, that's an open view into that lot. If somebody was there, they would have seen him standing there pacing back and forth, a police officer, obviously, which is one of the big things that leads us to believe that there was nobody there. Mm-hmm. Also, his partner that day, Bomenka, it only took him 8 seconds from the time the gunshots went off to him finding Sean shot in that lot. And there was nobody there. Also, there was gun smoke hovered around him. Had there been somebody struggling with him and shot him, that gun smoke would have been dissipated by the action of the guy running away. There's a lot of things that lead us to believe almost 100% that he committed suicide. But we only wanted to show what we know. When I said almost 100%, we only wanted to show what we knew 100%.
Yeah. How does that inform Jamie's performance, you think? I mean, because he's got to know, right, as an actor. I mean, I suppose he can make a choice. But when you're playing that on the day of and when you're talking to him about what this guy is going through, I guess it's possible for an actor to say, this is still a mystery and that. But like I was wondering about the absolutes that have to happen on set with an actor versus the absolutes of what you might depict on screen.
Yeah, so you take a show like The Wire, where we were writing as we were shooting, and the actors didn't know what was going to happen until the script dropped that week. And we never told them, we didn't tell Idris Elba that he was going to be killed until that script dropped, episode 311 in the third season, which effectively is like you're giving the actor his pink slip.
Yeah.
And the reason we didn't tell it is because exactly what you just said is we didn't want the actor to telegraph his performance, knowing that he was going to die. We didn't have that luxury with this. Jamie knew exactly what was going to happen, and it was in the news. And there were some interesting moments. There's a scene where he is on a call for a homicide scene, and he goes into this lot, and the lot was very similar in dimension to the lot that he would eventually be killed in. And I went, and Jamie and I both saw it. And there's just a little moment there at the end when, before he walks out of the lot, that he kind of looks around. He's foreshadowing his own death.
Yeah. I mean, it's an amazing performance. It's so still, it's so quiet, but it's there's so much underneath the tip of the iceberg there.
Yeah, he's really good, man. And you needed a guy who did a lot of acting with his eyes, and Jamie's that guy.
So George, with this, you know, as you said, this is over 3 years of work and commitment for a truly tremendous result. But you know, you're talking to us, so you know we're going to have to do it, inevitably pivot and ask what else is coming from you in the future. And if we, basically, I'll just ask selfishly, we've had some incredible work from you on the small screen, but we still want a Pelicanos detective show. We will keep saying this every week. We're going to keep asking for it and wondering where you are with that.
From your mouth to God's ears, right?
or Casey Bloys' ears, depending.
Yeah, Casey's listening. I have an overall deal at HBO. I would happily place any of my books there and I still want to do Derek Strange. You know,
yeah, I mean? That's the one, right?
Yeah. But right now I'm writing an adaptation of a John D. McDonald book called The Last One Left, with Megan Abbott.
Oh yes, that just got announced. I was going to ask you about that. Yeah. We love Megan too.
Yeah, she's great, and we're writing that together, and hopefully that'll go. We've written about half of it now. We know where we're going. For the big screen, I did adapt the first Travis McGee novel, The Deep Blue Goodbye, for Fox, and that apparently is going also.
I've been waiting for Travis for a long time, and I'm so happy that it came to you.
Honestly, like, this isn't just like publicist bullshit. Like, I read that book 40 years ago in the class that inspired me to become a crime fiction novelist. And 40 years ago, when I was, you know, 20 years old or 21, whatever it was, I said, I want to make this movie someday, you know, having never done anything. I hadn't written any books, any screenplays. And I finally got the opportunity. Amy Robinson came to me a couple of years ago. She had read that I had noted that book as an important book in my development, and she had the rights. And they've been trying to make it for 20 years.
Yeah. And Mangold was DiCaprio, Christian Bale. These are all people who were floating around it over time.
Right. I mean, they're ready to roll. Christian Bale tours ACL and it collapsed the project. But those were all contemporary. All those scripts were contemporary. And I said to Amy, I'll do it, but on one condition: it has to be period. Right? Because the character doesn't make sense in contemporary times. And I think I nailed it, man. I mean, I think it's a really good
story. Yes, I love it. I mean, I love also that it's period, because the thing when I tell people, and I had a similar thing 20 years ago where I got off of eBay, I got the box of all of them, and there's like 20, however many Travis McGee books, and I read them all chronologically. And to read those books is a moving picture snapshot of America over 20 tumultuous years. And he's of the time in the 60s. And then that last book, Lonely Silver Rain, the world is harsher, but there are more drugs. It's more violent. The environment's been destroyed. Florida's different. And he's confused in it, right? And that transition is so powerful as a reader that I love knowing that it's in the hands of someone who also gets that.
Yeah, I often wonder if McDonald didn't know he was going to die. He went up to, I think, Pittsburgh to get a heart operation, and he died in on the table, I believe. And he wasn't that old, but it's the perfect ending to that series. So yeah, there's that. I'm working.
And we know you're always working. We never have doubt about that. And are there books on the horizon as well? Or you've been busy?
I've been busy. I'm gonna keep doing this. Until I age out of it, which probably won't be long from now. And then the plan is to continue writing books until my death.
Well, it's good to have it all mapped out. George, thank you so much for joining us for the fourth time. We can't wait for the fifth. And thank you so much for this show. It's just absolutely incredible.
Yeah, congratulations on it.
Thanks a lot. I love what you guys are doing, man. I wanted to be on the show, so thank you.
Well, also, George, like, this is a moment. Sorry, Chris, I know we're done, but we have to revisit just that, like, I think you referred to Chris as the little guy with the camels, which we want to call him now. I'm going to call him that from now. Yeah, we can let the... Okay, so just to set the scene, we have now 3 or 4 times told an anecdote about you from our perspective. I don't know if we've ever given you the floor, and I think you've earned it.
Okay, thank you. So you guys are stuck on this thing. I was doing a book tour 20 years ago. And I came through, was it LA or San Francisco?
It was New York.
It was New York. It was the Lower
Union
Manhattan
Square.
Barnes.
It was Union Square. Okay.
It was lower. I think. It was like the 23rd. It was like Chelsea.
Okay.
All right.
So but who's remembering? Who's counting?
First of all, I didn't say the little guy. I said the guy who smoked camels.
There you go.
But Chris called me grandpa. That's what really got me.
No, that's not what happened.
And I am. Hey, by the way, I'm a grandfather now. I was 42 years old there, something like that. Anyways, so back then when you did a book tour, you did like in 30 days, you did like 28 cities. So every day I'd get up, usually I'd have to get up at like 5 and catch a plane to somewhere else. And you guys came in, I knew who you were, but I didn't know you guys. You wanted to go out and drink and watch basketball.
I mean, to be clear, you knew who we were because of our energy.
Yeah.
We were nothing. Like, we had not done anything. We were just super fans. But you could tell we were, in Pelicanos parlance, we were still in the Nick Stefanos stage of our development. And you were late book Derek Strange.
Okay.
We get that now. But at the time,
we
didn't.
It was just like, this was meant to be, man. The tournament is on. It's March Madness.
I know. And all I wanted to do was go home and drink a beer and watch the game. So that I could get up and because when you're on a tour like that, one night of debauchery can sabotage the entire book tour. And I didn't know you guys well enough to know, like, you're going to go to a bar, you're going to start buying me shots.
Yep.
It's hard to turn them down.
Look at Chris saying no. Yes. We are speaking to you now safely from a pronounced one beer while watching TV stage of life.
I was shaking my head because I was like, shots were light work back then. He would have been lucky to get off his shots.
We
would have been running the Princeton
story.
Offense by the end of the night. You know what I mean?
You were nice to us, I think, is our takeaway. It was in no way mockery. We were that guy's got it figured out. And we're not there yet.
Yeah.
And we're still not there, but you're setting a course for us, which we respect.
All right, we're square now.
I'm glad we gave you your opportunity for a rebuttal. George Pelicanos, thank you so much for joining the watch, man.
All right, thanks a lot, guys. Appreciate it.
Thanks, George. Hope to talk to you again soon. Take care.
Okay, bye.